Cincinnati is now hosting the largest exhibition on the Auschwitz concentration camp outside of Europe. Called Auschwitz, Not Long Ago, Not Far Away, the exhibition features hundreds of original objects from the site, including personal items that belong to survivors and victims. This is Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me in this recorded interview to discuss the exhibition and the Cincinnati stories it contains are Holocaust scholar and a curator of the exhibition, Michael Barenbaum, and CEO of the Nancy and David Wolf Holocaust and Humanities Center, Jackie Conjato. Thank you all for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Michael, for many Americans, when we think of the Holocaust and concentration camps, we think of Auschwitz. But this place in Poland wasn't always Auschwitz. Tell us about that history, where that came from.
Auschwitz is the German name. The town in which Auschwitz is located. And remember, the death camp of Auschwitz and the concentration camp and the industrial center of Auschwitz was located in German-occupied Poland. The town itself was called Oświęcim. Ironically, it was a deeply Jewish town with 8,000 of its 11,000 inhabitants being Jews, with a long and comfortable history of coexistence. But there was a unique characteristic of the town, which is it was located at a major railroad crossing where people went throughout the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which ruled the whole area for a period of time, and also where people transited from Poland and the Austro-Hungarian Empire into Germany itself. And that served as a key reason why Oświęcim became Auschwitz.
Ah. So many of us wonder, when we think of the atrocities, how could this happen? How does this exhibition, Michael, speak to the city before the German occupation and the rise of the Nazi Party?
There are, to tell the story of the Holocaust, you have to remember there's before, during, and after. Before, this was an ordinary town which had a large Jewish community. It was a town that itself had multiple industries, but it also was a town which was a way station for people transiting throughout the region. The Germans occupied this, and I say Germans because it was an act of state. And then beginning in 1941, they built a concentration camp there. And we use the term Auschwitz, but Auschwitz was actually three different types of camp. Auschwitz I was a concentration camp which housed Polish prisoners. Auschwitz III was called Bunimanowice, which was a huge industrial complex of roughly 50 square miles, which had multiple industries. And we have to remember something remarkable, which is that German industries far away from the front invested 700 million Reichsmarks in 1942, the equivalent of 400 million 1942 dollars, in the industrial base around Bunimanowice, which was going to depend on slave labor for its economy and why the industries invested. And those decisions were not made by the SS. They were made in the boardrooms of German corporations throughout Germany. The center of what we call Auschwitz was the death camp of Birkenau, birch trees, in which essentially it became a killing center. It's a place where between 1.1 and 1.3 million Jews, people were killed, 90% of them Jews. Mm. And that's where you get the sense of what the experience was. You had a rival. You then had essentially men were put to one side, women and children to the other. You had selection. And on a given day, selection meant that 80 to 90% of the people were sent immediately to the gas chambers. And Birkenau had four different gas chambers, B2, B3, B4, and B5. And this became, and they were replete with crematoria, because the problem, ironically, when you got around to murder, was not the killing, but what they called body disposal. And that is, it takes us much longer to get rid of a body and to reduce it to ashes than it does to murder them. So when you ask, how could this happen? What this exhibition tries to do is to tell you the two major characters of the story, and the third character, the third and fourth character behind the story. The two major characters of the story are the perpetrators, the killers, and the second are the victims, and they have a narrative all their own, and we personalize that narrative by telling you Cincinnati residents who, and people who made their home in Cincinnati who were there. And the two other characters that are less present but hover over it is the system itself that led to this killing, because this was an industrialized scale killing. And the last were the people who were either bystanders who saw and let it happen, who were enablers, or who were the very few whom we call upstanders, which is the people who saw what was happening and did something large and small to come to the assistance of the victims who were, without them, totally, completely, and thoroughly alone.
Jackie, why is it so important to explain the policies, the circumstances, and the decisions that led to what happened at Auschwitz, as this exhibition does?
I think so often we think about Auschwitz as sort of a standalone symbol of the atrocities of the Holocaust, but we ought to understand that, you know, as Al Miller, one of our local survivors, said, the Holocaust didn't start with bullets, it started with words. Or in the case of Auschwitz, it didn't start with gas chambers, it started with rhetoric, policy, dehumanization, which came about through legal means in German society. And so it's, I think the more we understand the context, the harder it is actually to separate ourselves, you know, the contemporary society we live in, where we have educated people who are making decisions about policy and, you know, how to deal with different things. It's harder to separate ourselves from what was happening at that time. And that's important because, you know, it's easier to look back and say, wow, that seems like something, not to use the language of the exhibition, but not long ago, long ago and far away. It happened over there, but not just physically over there and physically long ago. It happened outside of what I can conceive is possible in our world today, or what people I know could be possible, could be capable of. And I think that when we understand it in its context, we see that actually it wasn't that a nation of evil people just popped up out of nowhere in 1930s Germany. Germans in the 1930s were people like you and I who made decisions every day, relatively mundane decisions that either led to perpetration, that led to complicity, that led to upstanding or bystanding. And so, you know, I think it's important to contextualize it so that we can understand there are lessons for us today in this history.
Jackie, this exhibit has hundreds of artifacts from survivors and victims, including a suitcase with a local connection. Can you tell us just briefly about that suitcase and talk about the kind of poignant truth that these suitcases, that other families carried with them, that poignant truth that they tell?
The people who came through this building, this incredible icon in Cincinnati, Union Terminal, we would think around 2,000 of those people were Holocaust survivors, and they carried with them everything that they had. And in many cases, that was nothing. In some cases, that was enough to fit in a suitcase, maybe two if they were lucky. And so, yes, we have a very particular suitcase that was carried by a survivor, treasured survivor. They all are. But Werner Koppel was so active in sharing his story. He was foundational to the very beginnings of our work at the Holocaust and Humanity Center as the first survivor in Cincinnati to speak up publicly about what he had lived through at Auschwitz and in the death march out of Auschwitz. he was famous for saying, "I arrived at Union Terminal with a wife, a baby, and a suitcase, and that ended the first part of my life." And again, you know, sort of referencing these distinct chapters that he lived, right? It was like life before and life after Union Terminal. In the exhibition, we have Werner Koppel's suitcase. And so in some ways, you know, the suitcase has had quite the journey back to where it came through this building and really is a symbol.
People came from ghettos and they arrived in Auschwitz and they put all that they had in their suitcases, expecting that they were going on a railroad trip like Werner did to come to Cincinnati. They would arrive at a place, they would retrieve their suitcase, and they would build a life in whatever circumstances they faced. The other suitcases in the building are suitcases that were deposited by arriving prisoners who were then sent to die. And nobody picked it up. The Nazis had a place they called Canada because of the opulence of Canada, in which they took these possessions and they recycled them. They took the jewelry, they took the clothes, they took the shoes. They took everything that could be recycled from these suitcases because they arrived, but nobody could pick them up. And they were the counter testimony to what happens. And we also have what was in the suitcases. And think of what you bring when you travel. Everybody brings a toothbrush. Everybody brings, if they're men, they bring a shaving kit. You bring a hairbrush. You bring a pair of shoes. You bring a change of clothes. We have all of these objects of people who arrived, never picked them up, never got to use them again. And those suitcases represent the last thing they held before they were sent to die.
You know, Michael, you were just talking about these other artifacts that are in the exhibition, these other suitcases, these toothbrushes, these shoes, and nothing's known about the people who left those because they were murdered. They didn't retrieve their belongings. How does the anonymity of those objects, those shoes, those toothbrushes, how does that help reflect the horrors of what happened and our connection to the victims?
Let me talk about two small objects. As you walk into the exhibition, you see a beautiful high-heeled shoe. It's a red shoe. And you ask yourself the question, who was this woman who arrived in Auschwitz, presuming that she would have the opportunity to be elegant and wear a beautiful high-heeled shoes? And then you have another pair of shoes, a child's shoe, but a unique child's shoe because it has socks folded into the shoe.
Oh.
And you have to ask yourself, who folded the socks? Was it the child who was well brought up and took off his shoes, or it was in this case his shoes, and folded them up and put them there because he expected what, to come back and retrieve his shoes, as he might do at the beach, as he might do if he was going, into another sphere of fun activities? Or was it the mother who understood that her kid was taking off the shoe, her child, probably a one-year-old, a two-year-old child who was taking off the shoe. And in many respects, she put it there because she wanted it there when they came back, never imagining that she and he would be walking to their death. When you see them, we have a picture of the massive shoes. And there's an incredible poem which has a poignancy by a Yiddish poet by the name Moshe Shulstein, who said, "We are the shoes of grandparents and grandchildren from Paris, Prague, and Amsterdam. And because we were made of fiber and leather and not flesh and blood, each one of us survived the hellfire."
We're talking in this recorded interview about the exhibition Auschwitz, Not Long Ago, Not Far Away. It's on display now at the Cincinnati Museum Center at Union Terminal. Michael, there are also pieces of concrete from Auschwitz. Tell us about that.
Auschwitz had a, you know, you look at a camp and you look at its infrastructure. Auschwitz had a unique type of concrete lap that was straight and then the top was folded over. So, and it had barbed wire connections which were electrified. They were the pillars that outlined the camp, and sometimes they had double levels of barbed wire inside and outside, so that if you escaped one level, you came in between and you had to escape a second level. And part of the reason it was curved is to make sure you couldn't climb over it and you couldn't get out of it because you had nowhere to hold on. It also represented something else, which is every prisoner of Auschwitz could be as much as little as 10 yards away from the ability to end their life. It was called going to the wire. And if you went to the wire and you held the wire, you had the electricity that would electrocute you. So in one sense, when you got up in the morning and you didn't go to the wire, you recommitted yourself to the most atrocious and unimaginable conditions that you were to face during the day. Cold in the winter, an empty stomach, starvation, barely enough to get by, heat in the summer, not the opportunity to shower, not the opportunity to shave, and even not the dignity of having personal space to deal with your bodily functions. So when you look at these posts, you say, these people, if they escaped, they were killed. If they couldn't take it, they chose to die. And if not, they had to face the idea that every day they had the choice, limited choice that it was, limited agency that they had, between making the decision to recommit to an impossible life or to choose to end it.
Another one of the artifacts that I find chilling, I don't even know if I'm going to call it the right thing, but they're medical examination tables, I guess, but it seemed like they weren't necessarily used for medical examination. Talk to us about those.
Auschwitz is famous for its medical experiments. The head of the medical experiment, actually the number two man of the medical experimentation block, was Dr. Joseph Mengele. Mm. Now, you have to understand something about Joseph Mengele. Joseph Mengele was an MD, PhD. If you think of the Cincinnati Hospital Center and like, MD, PhD means a combination of an actual physician and a researcher. And he had the opportunity to use human beings as experimental objects without any necessity to keep them alive. He did particular experiments on twins and did another experiment on women because they wanted to create the circumstances in which German women could have multiple births with every pregnancy in order to achieve, to enhance, expand the master race. There's a very small detail that scholars know that we have to grapple with, which is that when Mengele left Auschwitz on January 16th, 1945, he brought with him his medical experiments, thinking that in the non-Auschwitz world, these would be his key to fame and prestige. He didn't need to make a fortune because Mengele family were the tractor manufacturers of Germany, the equivalent of John Deere, with and I don't make too many and make any moral comparison. You would think of a man by the name of John Deere. Joseph Mengele was of the John Deere type of family. And I apologize to the Deere company. I don't mean any comparison whatsoever, but that's how famous the name was. The second thing we have to understand is that when Mengele escaped to Argentina, after he understood he was a hunted man in Germany, he also brought his experiments with him, thinking that they would be vindicated by history and he couldn't give them up, even though they implicated him. So the medical experiments were essentially, and there were 28 institutes of higher education that held chairs in this type of biological research, trying to, prove that there was a master race and show that Germans were the master race and all other groups of people were subordinate, subservient, and the like. So, for example, Poles who were considered Slavs were attacked. Black Germans were attacked because they were considered Rhineland bastards. So Nazism was an overall system. Its central target were the Jews, but not its sole target. And there were a range of victims. And interesting, and our listeners will not know this, the first to be killed were not Jews. The first to be killed were Germans of special needs. Let me use German language and non-PC language. The mentally retarded, the physically infirm, the emotionally distraught, the handicapped, who are an embarrassment to a master race. How do you have a master race with such people among you? They were called life unworthy of living and useless eaters.
There were these conditions in Germany that led to this strength of the Nazi Party that made Germany vulnerable to the rise of this awful power. What should we learn about that? What does it say about, you know, how something like that can kind of creep up on a society?
I think, and you know, Michael can share pieces of this as well, but I think foundational for me is that the Holocaust is a lesson in the dangers of dehumanization. And when we're able to be manipulated or intoxicated by an ideology that is a dehumanizing ideology, then we can be convinced fairly easily, actually, and convinced that we're not only not bad, but that we're actually righteous, that we're morally righteous and we're good in eliminating the dehumanized entity. So I think that, you know, that is a foundational lesson, that when we see and identify dehumanizing rhetoric, action, policy, these are very slippery slopes. And this is how, again, millions of people, otherwise everyday Germans, could either participate or stand by. The other piece is the endurance of anti-Semitism, the insidious nature of anti-Semitism, the conspiratorial nature of anti-Semitism, and the tropes, the idea of this sort of demonic Jew that persists for centuries. We see in the Holocaust a case study of the worst possible outcome of anti-Semitism. And so as we see that on the rise again today, we need to be attuned to it. We need to make sure that we're not inadvertently trafficking in it or participating in it. And I think this is an important warning sign there too.
Well, I've been talking with Holocaust scholar and a curator of the exhibition, Professor Michael Barenbaum, CEO of the Nancy and David Wolfe Holocaust and Humanity Center, Jackie Conjato. Thank you all so much for your time today. The exhibition Auschwitz, Not Long Ago, Not Far Away is at the Cincinnati Museum Center at Union Terminal. More information is available on our website, wvxu.org. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez-Cornu. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.